headlines this hour. Israeli forces kill two Palestinian men in raids in the occupied West Bank. An influential British think tank says household incomes in the UK will fall 10% in the next 2 years, the steepest of such a drop in a century. And Russia warns Moldova that threatening the security of Russian troops in the breakaway region of Transnistria risks triggering military confrontation with Moscow. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have killed two Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank amid rising tensions. One of the victims, Yazan Afana, was shot dead during Israel's storming of a neighborhood in the city of Al-Bireh. The second victim, Samir Khalid, was killed by Israeli fire during a regime's raid on the Balata refugee camp east of the city of Nablus. In recent months, the Israeli regime military has stepped up deadly raids in the occupied West Bank, launching fiercest assaults on the local population. The raids usually lead to clashes with Palestinians protesting the Israeli violations. Israel plays with fire and exposes the region to grave dangers. That is the Syrian foreign minister's warning over Tel Aviv's recurrent attacks on Syrian soil. Faisal al-Maqdad says that Syria will not remain silent regarding the attacks and that Israelis will pay the price sooner or later. The top diplomat says the U.S. and other Western countries are responsible for encouraging Israel to ramp up aggression and to threaten regional security. The Israeli regime carries out repeated attacks on Syria, with the latest incident targeting Aleppo International Airport with missile strikes. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The British think tank says household incomes in the UK will fall by 10% by the end of next year, and that will be the biggest drop in the standards of living for at least a century. The Resolution Foundation focuses on the standards of living for low- and middle-income families. Projects household spending power in Britain will likely be cut by an average £3,000. The analysis says soaring energy bills will push an extra 3 million people into poverty. The Resolution Foundation says the outlook for living standards in Britain is, quote, shocking and terrifying. Blames both the war in Ukraine and low growth in earnings over the past decade for the current circumstances. The UK inflation currently stands at a 40-year high of over 10%. Speculations are that it could climb to over 18% next year. Syed Pouras is our correspondent joining us from London to give us the latest. Mick Napier is an activist and commentator who joins us from Edinburgh. Welcome to you both. Syed, first over to you. I'm not too sure how you see it, but it seems like every other day the UK is standing out more amongst other European countries with bad news for its economy. Nevertheless, tell us what you have on the latest report here that the standard of living for Brits is going to fall by what we understand is 10%.
That's correct, Covey, although other European countries are also experiencing their fair share of falling living standards and economic problems. The UK going to be the country in the Eurozone that we it left that will have the slowest growth in 2023. And this these findings by the Resolution Foundation really lay bare the enormity of the task that is at hand for the next prime minister, who will be announced on Monday next week. But this is not the first time this is happening. This is the peak, let's say, of two decades of stagnation in living standards in the UK. Last time they talked about it, that I recall, was under Theresa May and her chancellor, Philip Hammond, and now things are taking a turn for the worse. One major driver of why this is happening is the soaring energy costs. You pointed to the war in Ukraine, and that is very correct. And it looks like, as the war rages on, things are going to take a turn for even worse in the coming months and years. We saw, for instance, the Russian energy giant Gazprom shutting off the Nord Stream 1 pipeline for 3 days for maintenance work, and that has sent gas prices already. Here, the energy cap that is decided by Ofgem, the regulator, has already risen up to unthinkable, unimaginable highs of more than $4,000 from $1,000 only in 2019. And the way it looks, it's going to be revised yet again past October to more than $6,000. And this is the same regulator that used to revise its energy cap, only energy price cap, every 6 months. Now it's cut it down to every 3 months. And that is happening as inflation is at a 40-year high, although different people will experience inflation differently. If you're on the lower third of on the income scale, you will be experiencing an inflation of, let's say, 15%, and those who are earning more will be experiencing less inflation that will hit 15, some people say 18, and others are even saying 24% between now and 2024. And all of this is happening when wages are not, they are increasing, but not fast enough to keep up with the soaring cost of living and inflation. And we've seen a lot of industrial action as a result over the past months, as we're reporting. Most recently, a decision yet to be made by people working for the NHS, the National Health Service, on whether or not they're going to go out and strike again, asking for a higher wage rise of 15% compared to the more than 4 or 5% offered by the government. Reports of some hospitals even turning their some of their rooms into warm rooms so that they're staff can sleep in, because they can't, they won't be able to go home, and they can't keep their homes warm because they simply cannot afford to pay off their bills, because they're not getting a big enough raise to be able to do that. And so what that does is it contributes to a very dire outlook as far as income growth in this country, as far as living standards in the coming months and years. So what we're looking at again is soaring inflation, soaring cost of living, and wage stagflation, making life very difficult, in particular for low-income households. As you mentioned, 3 million people to be added to the already 10 million Britons who are living, according to the Resolution Foundation, in absolute poverty. You're looking at a rise in the number of children who live in relative poverty between now and 2024. And so what is going to happen is life is going to be very difficult for people here, especially if you're, as I say, not earning enough to be able to keep up with unbridled inflation in the coming months and years. And what that means is that the next person who will be taken over from Boris Johnson as prime minister will really have their work cut out for them to be able to attack this problem head on. But as I say, as far as the war in Ukraine rages on, as far as there's no willingness or intent, it's so it seems, from Western nations to put an end to it, to find this negotiated settlement to it, things are only going to get worse as we move on.
Well, Mick Napier, one thing that our correspondent there said very correctly is that based on this report, it's not just because of the war in Ukraine that UK's economy is finding itself where it is at now. But the war in Ukraine obviously has exacerbated the situation. When are the people in charge going to say enough is enough? I mean, I'm not too sure how much worse this can get. I mean, it's getting to be, it's getting to the point from, again, from what a correspondent there said, that people's lives are at risk, really, when you have so many people in poverty and all the different experiences that they're, hardships that they're experiencing. What do you think about this whole situation?
The figures were already pretty grim before the massive increase in energy prices and before the beginnings of the war in Ukraine, and the, you know, it's becoming clear a proxy war between NATO and Russia. Before then, there were already figures, I can't remember the detail, but millions of children, millions of households in Britain had children going to bed hungry most nights. I listened to the testimony of a dinner lady, somebody who works in a school giving out meals to children. And she was in tears saying that she had taken on that job because she loved it and she likes to make kids happy and make sure they're well fed. But now what she has to do is to turn away significant numbers of children every day who come in the queue for their meal, probably the only really good meal of the day some of them can look forward to, and she turns them away because they don't have credit in their account. And it's really, she said, breaking her heart. So the tales of suffering were already building up. But you know, war is always expensive. Some people make a lot of money out of it, but a lot of people have to pay. And you know, the energy spike is not the only thing that's going on, but it's the thing, it's the huge log that's going to break the camel's back. Because British workers are, you know, with a small C, they're pretty conservative. They'll try to muddle through, they'll try to avoid a struggle very often. But at the moment, the arithmetic just doesn't add up. They can't feed and heat. They can't feed their families and heat their homes. However they try, it just can't be done. And I'm reminded of the poll tax, where once the government had taken a step too far, there was no retreat. Margaret Thatcher was ejected from 10 Downing Street. Riots took place in London squares and McDonald's were trashed. And the mood, that by itself would not have created the crisis. The police can deal with that. But the mood across the country was very angry and very sullen and was refusing to condemn those people who were trashing McDonald's. And I think we're at the stage of something very similar, perhaps even much, much more intense than there. So, I mean, at one level, the crisis could be solved. Our government could start to negotiate peace with Russia, could start to use diplomacy, could ask that the gas be turned on, not 10% or 20% of it, but all of it. They wouldn't be chasing gas around the world to try and minimize the disaster that's unfolding. That aspect of the disaster could be ended. But the government refuses to do that. It is tied in to a war at home against people here, against the poor, who are certainly going to die in increased numbers, whose health service is going to be starved of funding, so that there are almost 50,000 nursing vacancies. All these wards and aspects of the health service that people here love, absolutely, you know, think is one of the greatest things about Britain, and they can see it beginning to falter before their very eyes because it's starved of funding, and so on and so on. But you know, the war in Europe is going to come into everybody's homes, and the suffering of the poor in this country, not just the poor, everybody will suffer, but the poor will suffer to such a degree that they simply cannot endure the current status quo. And you know, I think the can't pay, won't pay campaign, which is just beginning to move, will find a resonance in many working class areas. And you know, even this government began to cancel student loans because students simply couldn't or wouldn't pay back the loans they had received from the government. And once people in a bitter winter go into debt on energy, on oil and fuel and electricity and so on, once they build up massive debts, I think it'll be impossible for the energy companies and the government behind them to recover that funding. So however you cut it, it just doesn't seem possible for millions of people in Britain to endure what's coming down the line towards them. And at the same time, we have to say the government's absent without leave. There is nothing coming from the Conservative government until this election, for their leader is over. All we get from them, from Liz Truss, is an old post to say that one of the major problems with the British economy is lazy workers. And you know, something equally scandalous from Rishi Sunak. So they're absent. The whole thing is fermenting. People are suffering and living in fear. What's going to happen to old age pensioners? What's going to happen to people in care homes when the cost of fuel to actually heat those care homes, which have all been privatised pretty much, begins to be impossible? You can't turf the old people onto the street You just can't. So I think we're headed for a prolonged crisis. I don't see a solution in terms of conservative government policy, and I can only see great social upheaval. One from organised workers and trade unions, your correspondents quite rightly, alluding to the fact that we see this all over the place, from barristers to ballots of health service workers, but also among the unorganised people, the vast section of the labour force in the gig economy who are already living on the edge. They're going to be pushed over the edge. How will they respond? I think social unrest, trade union militancy, the future looks very dramatic indeed.
Thank you for that. Mick Napier, activist and commentator, and thank you, Syed Pouris, our correspondent there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. The flame of war in Ukraine is apparently expanding to Moldova. Moscow has warned the country against threatening the security of Russian forces. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says threatening the security of Russian troops in the breakaway region of Transnistria would be considered an attack on Russia. Lavrov cautioned against a potential military confrontation with Moscow. Russia says its army is there to maintain peace and stability, but Moldova wants Moscow to withdraw its forces. Moscow has had peacekeeping troops deployed in Transnistria since the early 1990s. Back then, an armed conflict saw pro-Russia forces take control of much of the region from Moldova. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
It appears that we're in for another week of pins and needles, waiting for court filings in the case of Donald Trump's stolen classified documents, which prompted the FBI to get them to a safe place away from where odd wandering MAGA fans and foreign spies can get to them. The article you're about to hear has been written by Heather Digby Parton. Heather Digby Parton is a columnist for the website Salon.com. The article is titled, "Trump's Threats of Riots and Violence Shows He's Desperate, Knows Legal Case is Weak." It appears that we're in for another week of pins and needles, waiting for court filings in the case of Donald Trump's stolen classified documents, which prompted the FBI to get them to a safe place away from where odd wandering MAGA fans and foreign spies can't get to them. The affidavit for the search warrant was released last week and showed that the government had tried for months to get Donald Trump to give the documents back, and he either lied, saying everything had been returned, or made fatuous excuses as to why the government had no claim to them. Next week, we can expect that the Department of Justice will respond to a different judge's request on Trump's behalf that they show why they don't need to appoint a special master to determine if any of the documents should be shielded by executive privilege. If so, that could take months, so Donald Trump's usual delaying tactics may succeed once again. But importantly, that's the only success that he's having at the moment. Donald Trump and the Republicans originally thought the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago would be a big help for his and the party's political fortunes, so they immediately jumped upon it, screeching that the FBI was acting like the Gestapo and predicting the beginning of a civil war in America. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, superciliously declared the raid on Mar-a-Lago is another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. But it's not looking like the big winner that they thought it was. CBS News polled the question last week and found that a large majority, including 20% of Republicans, believed the search was done to protect national security and not to persecute Donald Trump. Then this week, the Sunday news show suddenly had trouble finding Republicans who were willing to compare the FBI to the East German Stasi, or the Department of Justice's decision action to Stalin's Great Purge. Retiring Senator Roy Blunt, appearing on ABC's This Week program, reluctantly admitted that he should have turned the documents over, and apparently he turned a number of documents over before petulantly whining about the government waiting until it was close to the election before seizing them. The government, from nearly all accounts, was trying to give the former president a way out of the mess, and he refused to take it. And more directly, to Senator Roy Blunt's complaint, Donald Trump is just a disgruntled former employee at this point, sitting on a bunch of highly sensitive national security documents at his resort hotel. He's not on any ballot in November. Both New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, both widely touted as moderate Republicans, also hemmed and hawed that maybe the FBI did the right thing, but then maybe they didn't, and that we need transparency, and that it's difficult since this is a matter of national security. Their discomfort was palpable. Nobody knows just how bad things will turn out to be. Since that first day when the entire Republican participated in their mass primal scream, we've learned that Donald Trump has stashed at least 700 documents, some of them marked with the most top-secret designations that exist. That's very difficult for the Republican Party that's been chanting "lock her up" for the past 5 years to defend. Donald Trump, meanwhile, has been throwing everything at the wall on this one, and none of it seems to be sticking. The political benefits aren't materializing, while the legal threat he faces is so very real. So he's now deploying his most dangerous strategy, one he hinted at right after the search when he sent a cryptic message to Attorney General Merrick Garland. President Trump wants the Attorney General to know that he has been hearing from people all over the country about the raid on Mar-a-Lago. If there was one word to describe their mood, it's angry. The heat is building up. The pressure is building up. Whatever I can do to take the heat down, to bring the pressure down, just let us know. According to the New York Times, this strange message had the senior leadership at the FBI befuddled. I actually doubt that. These are people who prosecute mobsters all the time, and they know a veiled threat when they see it. And it's certainly not the first time they've encountered it with Donald Trump. They're in the midst of the largest investigation in history with the January 6th insurrection cases, which are a direct result of Donald Trump's incitement. He was letting the Attorney General know that he might have to unleash his mob yet again if they pursue this case, and they know it.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses one of these, a smartphone. But what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene. Because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on Earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bans, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwanda and Burundian people, because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the post public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against Congolese people for any small thing. You could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay that price or your family member would pay that price. Even you yourself would pay that price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. Though many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery, the oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines, and it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tedé Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold's reign you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule. Proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of this suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku. They're top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is, beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, You know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tetti Kufe. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.